Okay, good morning, members. I'm going to call our House Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. And I just want to remind the general public that you can find all of our committee meeting materials on the Minnesota House of Representatives website under committee list. Go to Human Services, and you'll see the agenda with all of the bills listed, the amendments, letters of support or against the bill. And then other support materials about overviews of the bills. Okay, the first thing on the agenda is to take the roll. Ms. Hansen.
Good morning, everybody. Chair Schultz.
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner.
Present.
Lead Albright.
Good morning.
Good morning. Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Burkle.
Present.
Representative Fisher.
Fisher, present.
Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hansen.
Hansen, present.
Thank you. Representative Keel.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Knorr.
Present.
Representative Novotny. Thank you. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, present.
Representative Pinto?
Present.
Representative Rasmussen?
Rasmussen, present.
Thank you. Representative Robbins?
Present.
Representative Sandel?
Present.
And Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, present.
Thank you, members.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. We have a quorum. See, Representative Robbins, would you like to move the minutes from February 11th?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Robbins moves the minutes from February 11th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion prevails. The minutes from February 11th, 2021 are adopted. So today we are going to be busy today. We have three bills on the agenda. So the first bill for consideration is House File 375. So I move that Representative Joachim's bill, House File 375, be recommended to be placed on the general register. So we have the bill before us. Representative Joachim, welcome to the committee, and why don't you please tell us about your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for hearing House File 375. This bill has traveled through the Behavioral Health Committee where it had bipartisan support and is now before you, and I truly do appreciate you hearing this bill. We have all witnessed the growing stress that our young adults face today and have heard testimony in many of our committees about the need for mental health support in our schools and in our communities. While the stress our students face existed before COVID-19 and will exist after, the global pandemic has shown a harsh light on the lack of support and a safety net for those students struggling. This bill is just a small step that we can take to give our students the tools they need to access mental health supports before things become dire. In current law, a 16 and 17-year-old is allowed to check themselves into an inpatient facility of their own accord, but cannot access the help of a mental health professional in an outpatient setting without parental permission. I first learned of this odd discrepancy when I had coffee with Ms. Liv Steen, an engaged student that you will hear from momentarily. With this bill, it is our hope to allow young adults to get the help they need long before requiring a hospital stay. Delaying urgent care can be costly in so many ways. Sometimes these delays can be as simple as a language barrier or time constraint for the parents of the student, or it may just be lack of knowledge of the resources available. Whatever the case may be, we want our young adults to get the needed help without that costly delay. Members, you should have letters of support in front of you for this bill. They're from NAMI, the Minnesota School Psychologists Association, and the Minnesota Psychology Association. I also have two incredible students here today to share their stories with you. Liv Steen's a Hopkins High School senior who was a member of the Hopkins School Group called Mental Health Matters, and she also serves on the Minnesota Youth Council. And Linda Nyakundi, a Hopkins High School senior as well and a member of Mental Health Matters. I also have Holly Magdance available for questions here from the Hopkins Public Schools, where she serves as the coordinator of Unity Partnerships. I would like to now turn it over to the voices that really matter in this discussion, our students.
Thank you, Representative Joachim. So the first testifier, please introduce yourself to the committee and state your affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mrs. Chair. My name is Liv Steen. I'm a senior at Hopkins High School and president of Mental Health Matters, as well as a representative for the Minnesota Youth Council. Mental Health Matters works to bring student voice and advocacy into school mental health. A few years ago at Hopkins High School, we were assessing the barriers to mental health services at school. The two biggest barriers we discovered were transportation and parental consent. Parental consent is often an issue due to family dynamics, cultural differences, and generational differences. I've had friends and fellow students tell me about the struggles of bringing up the topic of mental health in their homes. They told me their parents would tell them to suck it up or mental illness isn't real. I've had friends who have spent years trying to convince their parents to let them go to therapy. And it is not because their parents didn't care about them, but because they were afraid of their child suffering. And letting them go to therapy is like admitting that their child is suffering. No parent wants a child in pain. A similar thing happened to me with a key difference. We spoke about mental health in our house, and still it took an unnecessary amount of time to convince my parents to let me go to therapy. I know that I was very lucky, especially acknowledging the generational differences of my parents and I. My mom, 65, and my dad, 71. The decision must have been even harder for them, knowing how many mental blockages there are due to their age. I reached out to Representative Joachim two summers ago to get the ball rolling around this bill. That is where, in the process, I reached out to students and former students around the state who have had similar experiences. Here is an excerpt from one of those former students. Mental health had never been discussed in the former student's household. And when I brought it up, it was shrugged off and seen as not a Black people thing. Later, I was ridiculed for isolating and missing school due to my depression. This went back and forth between my parents. They made me feel like there was something wrong with me, the former student continues. How was I supposed to think anyone would listen? It definitely didn't make me want to stay here, meaning alive. They later go on to tell me about how this made them resistant to treatment later on. But once they grew out of it and started outpatient treatment, they said it was nice to have someone to acknowledge the significance of their pain. That is just one of many students or former students whose parents were not horrible people. Their parents just grew up differently, and that made the road to recover harder than it should have been.
Thank you, Ms. Steen. Our second testifier is Linda Nayakundi. Please welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and members. I am Linda Nayakundi with Mental Health Matters, and I chose to volunteer in support of this bill to bring to your attention another point of view on this topic. I was born in Kenya into a culture where discussing topics like mental health was looked down upon. I believe I can speak for most when I say I'm incredibly thankful for the mental health resources that my district has available. As I continue to grow older and learn a lot more about mental health, I have found it to be rather difficult to have these conversations with my parents. Especially in the recent year, I had a really difficult time adjusting to the new norms that were brought onto us because of COVID-19. I'm a rather social person and utilize in-person interaction to charge my social battery. Going into distance learning last spring and having to stay at home for the greater majority of the summer had a really negative effect on my mental well-being. When I would try to bring this issue up to my parents, their immediate response was to either take a walk or take a nap. But as you can imagine, those rather self-isolating remedies wouldn't really work on someone who thrives in a social environment. Starting the school year last fall also posed another aspect that had a rather negative effect on my mental state. I have struggled with seasonal depression in the past, but I've always had the ability to join clubs and organizations to help me keep busy and connecting with other people. Not being able to do that this school year has been rather difficult and has made learning a strenuous task. I had recently looked into some local teen counseling resources, and I've spoken to a few professionals on the phone about my potential counseling needs. And in every conversation, I've been told that eventually my parents would have to give consent in order for me to receive therapy. I know that if the news were to make it to my parents that I was seeking counseling, it would be shot down immediately due to the fact that they do not approve of speaking about personal issues with people outside of our household. Knowing that I would be able to make the decision on my own if I was seeking help would be a sigh of relief and give me more time to help explain and ease this conversation with my parents, all while being able to still get immediate help if needed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nyakundi. Representative Joaquim?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I would really like to thank the testifiers for bringing this bill idea forward and for being willing to share their stories with all of you. We now stand for questions.
Okay, members, we need to take a voice vote. I moved too quickly. So we need to adopt the division report from behavioral health. So I move to adopt the division report from behavioral health so we actually have 375 in front of us. And this is a voice vote, member. So I'm going to ask you to unmute yourself. All those in favor of adopting the division report from behavioral health, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the motion is approved. Now we have House File 375 before us, and I recommend that we place it on the general register. Okay, questions for Representative Joaquim or for the testifiers? Representative Bonner.
I think Madam Chair, Representative Albright may have been first.
Okay, sorry, Representative Albright.
Ladies first.
Representative Bonner.
All right. Well, thank you for that. I just really briefly wanted to say thank you to both of our testifiers. I know that it takes a tremendous amount of courage to come forward and to speak to this. It's often an issue that's very taboo, and while I rarely speak about it, I will tell you that there was a time in my life in college when I experienced something very similar to what you are now. I lost my grandmother, who was the most important person in my life, and my aunt, both to cancer within a very short amount of time, and about a half dozen members of my family within about a 2-year span. And it took a heavy toll. And I think seeking help is often the hardest part of that equation. It is the most challenging by far. And so I just want to commend you both, not only for having the courage and the self-awareness to recognize that and to seek help. And I think especially for our youth, often getting them to a place where they are willing to ask for help is probably the biggest barrier. So finding a way to remove any additional barriers, I think, is paramount. And so thank you, Representative Joaquim, for bringing the bill forward. And thank you to Liv and to Linda for being able to speak out today. I know this is a really big deal to be able to talk about this. So thank you very much for your courage.
Thank you, Representative Bonner, for those comments and for sharing. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that Ms. Abderholden is on this call, so I'm going to just let her know that it's either she or to Representative Joaquim that I will direct my questions. Representative Joaquim, on line 1.7 of your bill, I note, and I apologize for the series of questions I'm about to ask, but it says effective consent. What does effective consent define itself as?
Representative Joaquim?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That is a very good question. We took this language out of the same area where you already can give effective consent to do inpatient treatment. So we were just taking that language from that I work with nonpartisan staff from. So I don't know if nonpartisan staff knows of other parts in statute that define what effective consent is, or if Ms. Abderholden has some thoughts on it.
I'll first go to Ms. Abderholden. Please introduce yourself to the committee and state your affiliation.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. Representative Albright, I don't know the difference between an ineffective consent or an effective consent. I think you know, again, it was already in that part of the statute, but I don't think there's, I don't believe there's a difference, but I'm not an attorney.
Let me defer to our House research staff, Ms. Clarkvist or Sunderman.
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, as Representative Joachim said, this language was modeled based on other statutes regarding consent of minors to health services in Chapter 144. And those statutes use the term effective consent. So that's the term that's used in this bill as well. It's not a defined term. As an example, Section 144.341 uses effective consent.
Thank you, Ms. Clark. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that clarification. And one of the concerns that I would have, while I certainly appreciate and support the need for mental health services for, you know, 16-year-olds and above, I think the import of getting it right the first time is what we're all trying to achieve. And when you say effective consent, I think about the terms, whether that is giving consent orally, verbally, or if it's in writing. And the reason why that is so important from a legal perspective is that you're requesting and you're consenting to services that someone has to pay for. And under current law, a minor cannot enter into a mutually binding contract, which means that someone else has to be notified to the engagement or to the consent. And that typically would fall to someone like a parent, a guardian, a custodian, someone has a power of attorney, because there are legally binding and financial obligations that effective consent affords and actually obligates those in the majority over 18. And so that's why I pose that question. Representative Joachim, I think that, you know, going forward, that has to be of concern to you in lieu of just effective consent, because if you take a look at effective consent and you have an adult who's not notified of an engagement that their child has entered into, whether or not they agree with the diagnosis or the dialogue that I've heard from you two testifiers about their willingness or unwillingness to have a conversation about mental health. And this isn't an issue about, you know, child versus parent. It's about the legal obligation that parent has if you're offering a minor to effectively consent to have someone else who is unknowingly going to have to be responsible for the payment of those services. And so I'll leave it at that. And I would just raise one final question, Madam Chair, of Representative Joachim, in terms of, you know, we are, you know, in a throw of where, you know, the COVID has certainly thrown us into heightened awareness for mental health services. And I'm just wondering what, I know you serve on the education committees. I'm just wondering what avenues both counselors, mental health professionals at the schools play in your legislation here and how they would become more effective by this or would be negated if you're going directly to other sources. And maybe you or Ms. Abderholden could weigh in on that. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll leave it to
Thank
others.
You, Representative Albright, and Representative Joachim. And then if you need other assistance, let me know.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, I just want to remind folks that currently in statute, the minor of 16 or 17 can effectively consent to go to inpatient treatment by themselves without parental consent. Inpatient treatment, which costs a lot more than talking to folks on an outpatient sense and helping them get the counseling that they need. So currently they can put themselves into inpatient treatment. So that's already on the books. I would like to, and the students brought this to me because they thought that was a little backwards. And I think they're right. I think we should listen to them. They would like to be able to get help before it gets to that point. When it comes to, say, school-linked mental health programs or school psychologists, I have supported the school psychology. You see that letter in your school psychologist. You see that letter in your file because that access to that help is not available in every one of our schools. And from my understanding, and maybe Ms. Abner Holden, correct me if I'm wrong, even with school-linked mental health programs that are available, they're only able to give students one counseling appointment because of this statute right now. They can't go beyond that. But maybe Ms. Abner Holden would like to, if she'd like to add anything. Ms. Abner Holden?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sue Abner Holden, NAMI, Minnesota. With the school-linked mental health providers, some of the grant money can be used for students who are uninsured or underinsured. And so, you know, they could make sure that they're covering that. If they're a school support personnel, it doesn't fall into kind of the medical records and necessary clinical treatment, so they wouldn't need permission to talk to a student then, if that helps at all.
Thank you, Ms. Abner Holden. Representative Albright?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I applaud the concern, and we share the desire for providing these mental health services for folks. I think it's concerning that both testifiers, while it's meritorious, that they bring up the concern about or the difficulty in having these conversations with their parents, whether it be by age or by demographic. But I think there are responsibilities here that have not been entirely committed to, and so I would not support this bill.
Representative Joachim, I see Ms. Steen has a comment. Go ahead, Ms. Steen.
About your earlier question, I'd just like to make a comment that my school has full, like, free counseling services provided by the school. The one thing you need is parental consent. A few other schools have this around the metro, as well as there are some free or reduced cost teen clinics such as My Health and Annex Teen Clinic that you pay what you can. So currently they have that for reproductive health care that, you know, you can pay what you can. But if this bill went into play, then they'd have that for, you know, teens would pay what they can too, and then insurance wouldn't have to be involved, nor would the parents for financial concerns.
Thank you for that, Ms. Steen. I think Representative Fisher would like to add to this discussion. Representative Fisher?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to our testifiers, and thank you, Representative Joachim, for bringing this bill out here. This is a very important bill that is needed. I can say that based on the experiences that I've had in the homeless youth world, there have been too many times where we've run into situations where we've got youth who are homeless because their parents have abandoned them, and they are under 18. And the frustrating thing is when we've gone, these youth are looking for access to ongoing mental health services. And the parents at this point in time decide they don't want to, because we have to notify parents under 18, of kids under 18, where their children are. The parents at that point say, no, we don't want them having access to any of these services. And at the same time, they're taking absolutely no responsibility. And there are organizations that are out there that are willing to provide the services for free to these youth or for what they pay. And it's very important that we have these, because when the youth are experiencing trauma like that, it is important that they have the opportunity to be able to get the services that they're requesting, make sure that they can heal in the process. So I thank you, Representative Joachim, for bringing this forward. This helps a area where we've got many, many children who are homeless on any given night, and this gives them the opportunity to be able to get the services that they need when they need it.
Thank you, Representative Fisher. And I don't know why we would withhold services to those young adults that need it. What are there any drawbacks or costs, Representative Joachim?
Madam Chair, not that I think we reached out for a fiscal note and there was not any. The point of this is to make sure that students have access to the help that they need. And if you look at the letter provided by NAMI, parents are an important part of a student being able to heal and get the therapy they need. So although just getting rid of the hurdle of them having to access help to start with, through therapy, Therapists will always be working with the student and when they're ready and healthy enough to bring the parents in too. That is a big part of it. So this bill does not take parents completely out of the equation at all. It just makes sure that we get the students the help they need in a crisis situation before it gets to the point where, like I said before, currently they can check themselves into inpatient facilities without parental consent, facilities that are hopefully the kind of that last resort. We want to make sure that students have that, what they need to stay healthy before it gets to that point. And this bill just gives them that extra access. But parents are always part of that equation when it comes to making sure kids are healing and get what they need.
Thank you, Representative Joachim. So my question was not actually financial cost, but I don't see risks to implementing this legislation. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two really quick points, and maybe our lawyer will speak to this in a brief moment, but I do know that the term effective consent, specifically according to the law dictionary, means that we show active, knowing, and voluntary agreement to engage in activities. So just to kind of clarify that piece, so that is actually a legal term. But the other part that I wanted to mention is that I guess I'm thinking more about that prevention piece and making sure that we can get students access to the care they need early on before it gets to that crisis point. And I know I've seen that in my family and other families where there's a real need to get to this place. And I know the one thing we want to worry or concerned about is cost as well. And I just want to point out too that there is also currently a bill sponsored by Representative Edelson, 415, which limits the cost sharing on the first four visits. And the reason the number four is important is because generally speaking, that allows a patient to get a diagnosis by that fourth visit. And that opens up a variety of options for them to look at additional ways to get that additional help that they need and do so while being able to cover the cost. So, you know, I think we have multiple options here and we have a lot of really interested minds working to make sure that we're taking care of our youth, especially in a time where it's really challenging, you know, and I think Linda mentioned it before, you know, for those folks who tend to be more social, to move to this environment, you know, it's a little bit like cutting off our oxygen, right? And I think even as legislators, many of us are in that same place that Linda is. We understand what that's like to be cut off from our people. So by no means is that unusual, whether you're a youth or an adult, but certainly in this time, I think there's many reasons why we should be really thoughtful in about how we work to prevent more serious issues.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Joachim, for bringing this bill and to the testifiers. This bill will save lives. Members, our students are having a mental health crisis, and there was a mental health crisis already before the pandemic started. Suicide is the second leading cause of death for people aged 15 to 34 in Minnesota. As someone who has lost a close family friend when he was 17 years old, I know how critically important this bill is and other bills that are trying to protect our students' mental health and making sure that they have the services they need. And I am fully in support of this bill and hope members can get behind it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mulder. Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, I think that we've spoken to some concerns that voiced in different ways about this bill. Notwithstanding those, you know, I think we can all rally around the need for mental health services, particularly for 16 and 17-year-olds, whether that be in a school setting or a counseling session. I think there is room to amend this with some language that would give comfort to the issues that have been raised by my side of the aisle. I'm hopeful that Representative Joachim would consent to laying it on the table so that we could put an amendment together that would seek that bipartisanship that you have my commitment to do so as well. And I would urge just that we lay it on the table for a couple of days work on the amendment to square away the concerns we have, and then we can move it out of this committee with a unanimous vote.
Representative Joaquim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would prefer to continue to work with you as we move it to the floor. We both know that this is going to be a long process. I'm still just had the Senate author added and be more than happy to work with you offline on this. But I would defer to what Chairwoman Schultz would say, but I'd prefer to have it go out today and then we can work on an amendment before we have it up on the floor, because we all know that that's going to be a while before that happens.
Okay, my preference is to move it to the general register, and that doesn't mean you can't bring an amendment to the floor, Representative Albright, and continue to work with the author of the bill. Representative Albright, you still have your hand up. Do you have another question?
Just a point of clarification. I know that we're making a re-referral back to the general register. I'm just wondering, with the context of some of the issues that have been raised from myself and others, I'm wondering why it wouldn't go to judiciary as well.
Representative Joaquim.
Madam Chair, we're using language that's currently in statute, so I don't think we need to go to judiciary. But I'm not the judiciary chair, so.
We have determined, Representative Albright, that will go to the general register. Further questions, Representative Albright?
I've raised my concerns about this, Madam Chair.
Thank you for raising those concerns. So I'm going to renew my motion to place, I'm sorry, Cheryl, Representative Joaquim, do you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, members, for the discussion. And Representative Albright, I definitely do want to work with you to try to make sure that folks are comfortable with this bill. And I'd like to thank the students who have been extraordinary advocates for this legislation. If we are truly serious about addressing the mental health needs of our students, we need to do so much more than we're doing right now. This bill is not the only answer, as Representative Bonner pointed out. Our systems need funding. We need to invest in the health of the next generation. But this bill is a small step that we can take to give our students the tools that they need to access mental health supports before things become too dire. I ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Joaquim. So I'm going to renew my motion to place House File 375 on the general register. So this is going to be a roll call vote, members. Ms. Hansen?
Chair Schultz?
Aye.
Schultz, aye. Vice Chair Bonner?
Aye.
Bonner, aye. Lead Albright?
Pass.
Pass. Albright, pass. Representative Bolden?
Aye.
Bolden, aye. Representative Burkle?
No.
No. Burkle, no. Representative Fisher?
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Representative Frederick?
Aye.
Frederick, aye. Representative Hansen? Hansen, aye. Representative Keel? Representative Keel?
No.
Keel, no. Thank you. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Mueller?
Aye.
Mueller, aye. Representative Moore?
Aye.
Moore, aye. Representative Novotny?
Novotny, pass.
Pass. Novotny, pass. Representative Pearson? Representative Pearson? We'll come back. Representative Pinto?
Aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Rasmussen?
No.
Rasmussen, no. Representative Robbins?
No.
Robbins, no. Representative Sandel?
Yes.
Sandel, yes. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Pearson?
Pearson.
Pearson, aye.
Pearson, aye. Okay, thank you. So, Chair Schultz, that's 12 ayes. 5 noes and 2 abstain.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. The motion prevails. House File 375. It's recommended to be placed on the general register. Thank you, members. The next bill we have for consideration is House File 635. I'll move that Representative Bierman's bill, House File 635, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance Bill. So we have the bill before us. Representative Bierman, welcome to the committee. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members, for hearing HF 635 today. This is the school-linked mental health grants bill. Madam Chair, are we going to have a presentation as well from DHS on this, or is that just part of the packet?
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Would you like to have the presentation before your overview of the bill?
I'll make a couple comments and then we'll go to the presentation and then come back. So thank you. I just want to be clarified that wasn't that was going to be presented. So thank you, Madam Chair. So just a little history of this bill. These grants came out of a multi-year, multi-stakeholder group called the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group. They recognized at the time the barriers faced by families in accessing treatment for their children, including time, transportation, and the navigation of the mental health system and more. On top of that, they heard from families that often the schools didn't have the capacity or know exactly how to support their children in the classroom. So this bill was originally passed in 2007, with funding going out the door in 2008. So the grant money goes to community mental health providers who then co-locate in the schools. So maybe now would be a good time to present the DHS slides, and then we can come back to more discussion on the bill.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. We have DHS here. Ms. Lofgren, please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed with your overview.
Oh, there. Is my audio okay?
It is. Please proceed.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Kristen Lofgren with the Behavioral Health Division within the Minnesota Department of Human Services. I appreciate representatives' overview of our work, and we'll expand on that a little bit, again, with a general overview of school-linked mental health. My position is as the coordinator for the school-linked grants and development of the framework for school-based services between our providers and our school districts across our state. As representative noted, this program brings mental health providers to our school districts to support our kids and our families and teachers in their very natural environment. As we know, over one-fifth of our population is in our schools. It's where our families are, our teachers are, our kids are learning, and it's a natural fit to then bring that mental health service. And as representative noted, it was in 2007 it passed, and then we began in 2008 our development of bringing services to kids and families. At the bottom of the screen shows our three core objectives: to improve early identification and interventions for our kids, increase that accessibility, bringing services to where kids are, and to provide and increase our outcomes for our kids so they are successful in life, at home, in school, et cetera. Slide. Why is mental health treatment in schools and why is it important? A couple key points to note here is that when services are delivered and treatment is completed, youth are six times more likely when those services are provided during part of their educational setting and during their school day. It decreases their symptoms, and mental health services are most effective when they are integrated into our students' academic instruction during their school day. And the graph on the right side of your slide there just identifies some of the research studies supporting this. Slide. This is a graph showing, again, when we started back in 2008 until current and the increase in state appropriations over the years that supports our school-linked mental health grants to our providers in partnership with our schools. Slide. As a visual, I always love to see our great state and showing all of our dots, which identify our providers and our school districts across the state. This is also available on our website as well. And on the right-hand side is a list of our 28 lead contract agencies. In partnership with all of our subcontractors, we have over 58 providers who are providing school-linked mental health services in partnership with schools across our state. Slide. As you just saw on the prior map, where we're looking at over 1,150, the top graph line shows the total number of schools, programs where school-linked services are. The bottom line graph shows the total number of districts. Both are only representative of a little over half of our total school districts and programs across the state. So currently, we're only in a little over 50% of our schools. Slide. On the far left talks about where our services. So 54% are partnered within our elementary schools, 14% in our middle schools, and 28% in our high schools and or our alternative learning centers supporting our youth there. On the right side of your screen on the slide shows by grade level, again showing from pre-K to 12 plus. Pre-K is our early threes, early four programs operational in our schools. Our 12 plus is going to be our transition kids, traditionally kids that are receiving specialized instruction and still enrolled in school. Again, showing our total count of kids by grade and when kids are accessing services. We're seeing numbers earlier in the grade levels, which is a credit to the providers and the schools with the early identification. Slide. On the left of your screen, because clinical services are delivered and then the treatment plan is generated from a diagnostic assessment, generalized anxiety disorder has been one of the top diagnoses that kids are receiving. Attention deficit, adjustment disorders, and post-traumatic stress disorders are the diagnoses and treatment plans are being built from those in treatment for the child and for the family. On the right side of your screen is showing the common clinical services, what school-linked is. It's there, it's in the school day, it's communicating with teachers and parents to deliver clinical services within their school day. The diagnostic assessment, therapy, education, skills training, measuring outcomes through standardized outcome measures and the importance of the treatment planning, working with kids and families so we know what are we working on, what are we working toward. And ancillary support is going to be typically all of those essential and critical services as well, but are not typically funded and supported through primary insurance and Medicaid plans. So again, in partnership with our school districts, there's a lot of consultation time with parents and teachers, school-wide training and partnership, a lot of co-teaching and co-presentations between providers and school staff. Transportation, as mentioned earlier, we want to reduce that barrier. Typically, transportation is going to happen outside of school hours. There's a lot of work that happens in the summertime when school is not happening during vacation time when school is not in session. And importantly is that partnership component, and especially at that local level where providers and school staff are working within the framework to build within those mental health teams and our MTSS teams. Again, as mentioned earlier, our outcomes for kids is We're going to achieve better outcomes through quality service as our providers are increasingly receiving more training and evidence-based practices to deliver quality service that improves our outcomes for our kids. We're improving capacity in our infrastructure, again, with that partnership work within our schools and communities, hearing a lot, importantly, from our family members on what this needs to be to support them. And again, our partnerships with our whole school districts and development of MTSS and our positive behavior intervention and supports, PBIS. We do an enormous amount of work state agency-wise and cross-agency with the frameworks that are existing already in local school districts. Slide. COVID hit all of us and hit our kids and families and teachers especially hard. So much of the work that you've done and that we've done within DHS and MDE, quick turnaround when COVID hit was ensuring that all of these services that have been provided to our kids and families and supporting our teachers continued. We got waivers through before the end of March last year. We quickly rolled out and did some amendments to allow flexibility for our providers to continue that important work. We've been meeting consistently, DHS and MDE, with our related service providers. That's our school psych, school social workers, and also our school-linked mental health providers. Biweekly calls to share resources, talk about what's working across our state, give updates from state level as well. And importantly, at the local level is that collaboration of those distant learning plans. As districts were developing those distant learning plans, the important component is how do we continue to meet the mental health needs of our kids? And all of those plans were worked through at the local level. So, slide. Engagement strategy. So a lot of really big picture things. The importance is that connectivity. As we quickly move to telemedicine as our primary service delivery method, we were finding that a lot of kids and families, connectivity was an issue, broadband, width, strength, more families are working at home, more demands on families as parents are teaching. And so there was a lot of school district IT departments that were ensuring that those that their kids had the right app on their Chromebooks to ensure that we had that secured network to continue telemedicine services. Relentless spirit is one that has just kept coming up, and it comes up from schools and providers, is just the enormous effort in intentional collaboration to really ensure that we're meeting the needs of our kids and families. Quick turnaround from our therapists to reach out to families immediately, and utilizing the check and connect at all levels is when kids aren't in school consistently, we don't have eyes on them to ensure and just do some symptom check. And so providers have been strategic in how do we continue to check on our kids and check on our teachers and families to reach out and support as needed. Slide. This graph shows the by year. So these are calendar year 2019 versus 2020. So when we look at our first quarter a year ago, numbers were pretty consistent. COVID hit mid-March, and then we were measuring by quarter as we saw a decline in the number of kids that we were able to stay connected with during the pandemic. A lot of different strategies are being employed and developed. Enormous time is being spent. It does take more time and effort to coordinate sessions, track families, track kids, connect with teachers. But again, it's that relentless spirit that I always reference as we're building those numbers back up. And again, these numbers are reflective of the services that are provided in our school districts, again, only being about half of our sites right now. So our providers are seeing, and our recent phone call was that those numbers are coming back up. More and more referrals are coming in and managed through the mental health teams within our school. Next step is you're aware that school-linked mental health was included in the governor's budget recommendations. something to highlight is that the APBS there, the Association of Positive Behavior Supports at an international conference, will highlight the work and partnership work that MDE and DHS has been doing to support kids. As we move forward, too, is the importance of the inclusion of integrated care within our framework within our school. As we're reaching out to support more families through various methods, ensuring that we're addressing co-occurring disorders and substance use, chemical health within our schools, that work will continue as we move forward. Telemedicine, as mentioned earlier, is again that infrastructure development to ensure that that telemedicine piece is happening. And of reference too is within the last year, both MDE and DHS received federal SAMHSA grants to continue to build and enhance our current school-linked mental health framework. Slide. That concludes our overview and presentation at this point, Madam Chair. I will turn it to you. Thank you for this wonderful opportunity to share and present to you today on the work that our providers and schools are doing.
Thank you, Ms. Lofgren. I am going to move to the testifiers and then open it up for questions. So the first testifier we have is Sue Abderholden. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Member Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. I just want to say that the school-linked mental health program is really the best thing since sliced bread. You can talk to any parent, any teacher, any mental health professional, and they'll say that the presence of mental health professionals in the school has had a positive impact on both the students' mental health and their academic success. You have to remember that the symptoms of a mental illness do negatively impact a student's ability to concentrate, to remember, and it impacts them negatively both in terms of academics and socially. And this program helps people across the state, urban, rural, suburban, and I think that's another important piece. And I really believe that now more than ever, we need to be paying attention to this. According to recent Pew Research, 59% of parents are more concerned about their child's well-being. The CDC found this fall that the ER visits for mental health among children increased 24% for children ages 5 to 11 and 31% for children 12 to 17. Simply opening up the schools is not going to solve the problem. Children have been through a traumatic experience. They've been, you know, worrying about catching the virus or their family catching it, living in a household with high stress due to loss of income, having food insecurity, and more. We need to help these children understand and cope with what they've gone through. And it's extremely important that we plan ahead and address the needs of our children and youth. And I urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. The second testifier is Thomas Belcher. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Is my camera on?
It is. Please proceed. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Belcher. I'm the CFO of Greater Minnesota Family Services. We're a nonprofit mental health center based in Wilmer, Minnesota. We've been providing mental health services in schools for over 20 years now. As a DHS grantee, we're currently providing services in regional hubs like St. Cloud, Marshall, and Elk River, along with smaller districts such as Heron Lake, Grigla, and Lake Benton, to name a few. We have 60 providers, and we see about 800 students a year. Yesterday, NBC News released the result of a survey given to 10,000 high school students. It measured increases in stress since the start of the pandemic. Not surprisingly, 56.4 reported an increase in stress, 30.6 reported it staying the same, and only 13% reported a decrease in stress since the beginning of the pandemic. That's where school-linked mental health comes in. Despite falling referrals, revenue shortfalls, disrupted school services, Zoom fatigue, bad internet connections, and more failed appointments than we could count, we have and we will continue to provide consistent, skilled, caring mental health services for children in an environment where it makes sense, school. I think in these kinds of presentations, it's the students and parents that speak the loudest. I'm just going to read two brief
parental letters that we've gotten, thanking us for what we've done, and wrap it up. Lauren has provided fantastic services as we navigated the COVID world. In order for my kiddo to receive the necessary services last spring, Lauren seamlessly transitioned to virtual meetings with him and eventually allowed him to visit in person following COVID guidelines. My son wasn't able to connect in person with his social skills classes in his autism group last spring, but his continued interactions with Lauren minimized the backsliding we experienced during the autism-related services being paused. My son looked forward to meeting with Lauren, and she taught him crucial coping skills to help him navigate the uncertainty that he was experiencing. And here's the second one. We've searched for someone my daughter would connect with, and we haven't had any luck until we found you. I've seen her grow and change so much since she started seeing you in September. I appreciate the consistency with providing services throughout the distance learning period and when we had to quarantine. You never missed a session, and I made sure you made sure she was seen twice a week to help us keep that connection. She's an incredible girl, and I'm so thankful for all that you do, not only to help her, but all of us. You're amazing, and we're so thankful we found you. We thank you for your support for this program and for your interest in making the service available to all the children in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Belcher, and for that reading the letters from the parents. The third testifier is Lisa Zhang. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the members of the committee. My name is Lisa Zhang. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. I work for Change Inc. as one of the clinical
directors. Ms. Zhang, can you speak up a little bit or get closer to your mic? Thank you.
Okay. Sorry. I work for Change Inc. as one of the clinical directors that oversees our school-linked program in Minneapolis School District. We are in about 30 schools in St. Paul and Minneapolis School District, serving 612 students last year. School-linked mental health was never a part of my plan, and by chance, I fell in love with this work and have been doing this for 10 years. Schooling mental health is not easy work. When I am asked, what is it like to be a school-linked therapist? I tell people to be a culturally responsive and socially just therapist, we wear multiple hats to meet the needs of children and families. Even the school is our client. Connecting teachers and support staff as a team to support a child and family. We offer a trauma-informed lens and a lens into the homes of students to school staff. Last summer, 20 school staff came together in a meeting to support a single dad who had stage 3 cancer, homeless, living in a shelter. Sadly, in the middle of a pandemic, this dad lost his battle to cancer, leaving behind a 5, 8, and 11-year-old. But this very team continues to support these children academically and emotionally until the transition of their care to a relative out of state. School-linked mental health has increased accessibility to some of the most disadvantaged communities who are least likely to access mental health services. I've sat many times with refugee and immigrant parents sharing how school-linked therapy can help their child's emotional health. I imagine that this conversation would not happen if it were in a different setting because of language, cultural, economic and transportation barriers. I remember sitting in a living room with Hmong refugee parents and their 6 children. The parents identified me as a teacher because they didn't have context for a mental health therapist. I spent time building the parents' confidence in a new system by connecting them with their children's school, teachers, and any community support needed. There were moments where I was an interpreter, a case manager, an advocate, but also their therapist. By mid-school year, our caseloads are full because a school-linked therapist isn't just a therapist. We need school-linked mental health in every one of our schools. These families who are least likely to access services are now living in the middle of a pandemic. All the hardships they had prior to the pandemic is magnified. their child's emotional health is at the bottom of the list. At the top of their list are food, rent, utilities, and finding housing. When would a parent have time to focus on their child's emotional health? They don't. But because the SchoolLink mental health therapists are embedded in the school community, these families will get a warm phone call from a therapist asking, is there anything that you need? Are you okay? Is your child okay? It is through the SchoolLink therapist relationship with the family that this parent can slow down, share her burdens, check in with her children. It is the therapist that has been the consistent helper to the family before the pandemic, during the pandemic, and will continue to be after the pandemic. I thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for giving me this opportunity to share my experience as a SchoolLink therapist.
Thank you, Ms. Zhang, and thank you for your work as a therapist. We appreciate it. Representative Bierman, to your bill, please.
All right, Madam Chair, thank you very much. I just wanted to first off just mention that in your packets you have some letters from the Minnesota Association of Community Health Programs and Support and the Wilder Foundation, and some letters from school superintendents, various ones. But I also want to draw your attention to particularly the letter from the superintendent, Sherry Brodus. Please take a look. It's short and to the point, and just exemplifies why we need this program in place to continue. This program builds on the continuation of the good work that the school support personnel perform in schools. But members, we need both. So I would encourage you to read the information available and take note of, you know, our great presentation from Ms. Lofgren, which was broad but had a lot of detail, and then the personal stories of Ms. Zhang and Mr. Belcher about how important this is on the ground. It's truly an important program that years of data show that about half the children that are able to access this this therapy and treatment, half of them have a serious mental illness. And so we need to make sure that all children are receiving care and can be successful both at home and in school. So I want to thank the testifiers again, and thank you to the members here today to hear the bill and stand for questions, please.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know the time is waning for this bill to be heard, and so I'll be direct and to the point. Representative Bierman, on lines 1.9 through 1.11 of your bill, I want to draw your attention to a couple of questions I have. First is, you specify to providers that can serve schools. I would appreciate your elaboration in terms of what type of schools, if that is just public or is that parochial or private. Also on line 1.10, you say about the highest percentage. What's the cap? Where's the threshold for that in terms of meeting that guideline or not? And then on that same line, what are the metrics that are going to be used to identify those schools that have that highest percentage of special education students? Is that something that's coming through MDE or through DHS? Curious on your thoughts on that. And then just finally, I'll wrap it up, Madam Chair, and whomever wants to answer can. But I note that we're talking about mental health, and while I applaud your efforts, Representative Bierman, I'm wondering if you're also not cognizant, but also wanting to address those issues where there are co-occurring diagnoses, and I want to specifically note substance abuse. And while mental health can certainly be a standalone, you and I both know that there are a number of instances where both of those occur similarly. So I'm wondering how you would address, or Ms. Lofgren, how she would address a similar emphasis on substance abuse. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. That was a long list, so we may have to come back and follow up and make sure we got all your questions answered. Representative Bierman, if you can answer some of those, if you need house research, let me know.
Go ahead. Sure, Madam Chair, Representative Albright, thank you for those questions. All very good questions, very detailed. I think a lot of those questions go right to the fact that the mental health providers, both the school and with the support of the school counselors, they need to first identify and channel people into the appropriate care that is needed. As far as the exact statistics on what the numbers would be and the ranges, I would have to turn to the department for some of that information collected by Minnesota Department of Health, and maybe DHS could have some of those answers, which we could get offline. Questions were a wide range, but I think that it does come down to addressing individual students and letting the people on the ground just determine things like, you know, what are their real issues, whether they are that substance abuse or mental health issues, and how those are commingling and can make both issues worse for students. And that the important thing is that, you know, we are identifying that. And as the slide showed from the department, we're getting to students with this program at a much younger age, which is imperative to address those issues as soon as they're seen and noticed and apparent, and find them when they are not apparent to the teachers in the building. So I know that doesn't answer all of your questions, but if the department would like to chime in, I would appreciate their input as well to any of those.
Ms. Lofgren.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We appreciate the ability to respond back. And specifically, as Representative noted, with the co-occurring disorders, again, our frontline staff, our school support personnel, and our licensed mental health professionals within our schools do a lot of teaming to identify at what point is that referral made to that LADC, that LACSW outside to deliver that more intensive clinical services. And as we mentioned briefly in our PowerPoint, again, it's to speak to the expansion of SUD within our current school-linked mental health framework and how can we best support kids with SUD or chemical health issues. It has certainly been brought to our attention more over the last few years, specifically looking at that co-occurring where teachers and counselors are bringing to us. We also need to treat the mental health. Could we do some teaming between the LADCs that are school employed and our mental health professionals? So again, many things on our radar to continue to build and ensure that we're treating the symptoms for kids to be successful. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lofgren. Representative Albright. You're on mute.
What has been the appropriation in biennials passed?
Ms. Lofgren or Representative Bierman?
Madam Chair, I think the graph shown in the presentation gave us some of that detail. I think it started back in 07 around 4 or 5 million and has risen to 10 or 12.
Ms. Lofgren?
That is correct. Yes, we are currently at 11 million annually. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Bierman, final comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the committee again for hearing the bill. I just hope that you will continue this support for this critical program for the well-being of our students. This is not an area that we want to think about cutting back on, even in the midst of a budget shortfall. So we ask for your support for this bill so that we can continue a program that, as you've heard today, is working. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. So House File 635 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance Bill. Our last bill on the agenda is House File 287. Before that, we need to adopt the division report from Behavioral Health. So I'm going to move that we adopt the report. This is a voice vote. Please unmute yourself. All those in favor of adopting the division report, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, the motion is approved and the division report from Behavioral Health is adopted. So House File 287, I'll move that Representative Edelson's bill, House File 287, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Human Services Finance Bill. Representative Edelson, you have an author's amendment, I believe, labeled A1. you would like, I'll offer that amendment for you so we can get it in the shape you would like before you discuss it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So I will move the A1 amendment. Would you like to quick speak to the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair and members. The amendment ensures that the practices are culturally responsive as well, excuse me, as making sure that we have geographic representation as well as BIPOC community members represented in the study.
Okay, any other questions about the A1? All those in favor, please unmute yourself. Signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, the amendment is adopted. Representative Edelson, to your bill as amended, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's good to see you all virtually. I'm going to try to keep this pretty short because I know that we have several testifiers and not a great deal of time. House File 287 is pretty straightforward. It directs the Department of Human Services with stakeholders to conduct a study to make recommendations on sober homes. Sober homes right now in the state of Minnesota are largely unregulated. We have today here is the MASH, is the Minnesota Association of Sober Homes. They independently certify homes, and then they have a private investigator that they hire that does the inspections. And the guidelines that they use are from NAR, which is the National Alliance of Recovery Residences. But the critical thing I want members to know is not every sober home in the state of Minnesota is a part of MASH. So we have a gap. And so while MASH may have high standards, we have numerous sober homes, and actually we don't even know how many in the state of Minnesota that don't follow any of MASH's guidelines. So it's important to note that I support sober homes. I've been working with stakeholders and NAMI as well on this bill. Everyone understands that sober homes really provide an important part of the recovery process. So we know that a person's also very vulnerable during recovery. And it's important as a state we provide protections and oversight. In the nation right now, we're seeing a trend of sober homes being looked at. How do we do consumer protections? Connecticut, Georgia, Illinois are all parts of states that are doing it. There's many more. But these states have put in consumer protections without increasing costs, which is really important to note. So right now, before I go to the testifiers, I just want you all to know that Minnesota is known as one of the meccas, one of the places to come to get sober and to stay sober. And it's really upon us, this important, this conversation, to make sure that we're protecting people when they do come here and when they are getting sober. So, Madam Chair, I'd like to move to my first testifier.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. The first up is Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Abderholden, NAMI, Minnesota. I think it's really important that you read the language of this bill. It's really about bringing together stakeholders to increase access to sober homes, promote person-centered planning and cultural responsiveness, and develop recommendations on oversight, not regulations, not licensing, on oversight, and then to provide the consumer protections. Sober homes do play a very important role, and we're just trying to ensure some basic consumer protections. People who live in sober homes are not considered renters, and they're not considered patients, so they have no rights under those sections of the law. 50% of people with a mental illness also have a substance use disorder, which is why people have called NAMI about concerns with sober homes and why we're concerned about this issue. The complaints we have heard include homes being dirty, infested with rodents, use of drugs in the home, people being evicted late at night with nowhere to go, people losing their deposits when they leave due to the poor conditions, and more. The letter from the ombudsman also confirms that there are problems. And this is not just a state issue, it's a national issue. The 2018 support bill signed by President Trump mandated the Secretary of Health and Human Services to develop best practices around sober homes. The National Council on Behavioral Health and the National Alliance for Recovery Residents found there are inconsistencies in quality because there aren't state-enforced protections or standards. This report recommended that states adopt a common definition, establish a certification process, incentivize providers to adhere to national standards, and expand investment and technical assistance for recovery housing. SAMHSA issued a report on best practices for sober homes and include recommendations for states to define them and the services they offer, and advise that states adopt a process of certification to assure program quality. Good stories don't negate the fact that there are people who have had bad experiences. What we all want are safe, sober living homes so individuals can advance in their recovery. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Rory O'Brien, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, my name is Rory O'Brien. And Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Rory O'Brien. I'm the chapter leader of Minneapolis Students for Sensible Drug Policy. We're the local ambassador chapter of the largest global youth-led human rights network dedicated to addressing the war on drugs through sensible policy change. I also studied addiction counseling at Minneapolis College and do harm reduction-based street outreach. Over the past 2 years, we have been interviewing and meeting with former sober housing residents and sober housing managers. Some of them have submitted written testimony to NAMI. While people did have positive experience at their sober homes, they also still had concerns about how homes were run and were worried about how they saw some of the other residents being treated. Out of the people who wanted to discuss policy changes, there were more negative experiences than positive ones. The stories range from the common stories of being evicted after returning to use or relapse, to see people being evicted for not doing their daily chores, to residents being evicted and having sober homes call their place of employment, to stories where, in just a matter of weeks, multiple evicted residents had overdosed. One common theme we have been hearing from people opposed to a regulated system is that sober housing is a choice. According to data from the state's Drug and Alcohol Abuse Normative Evaluation System, in 2017, over 17,000, or nearly one-third of the referrals to Minnesota treatment programs came from the criminal justice system. In our interviews, people who were experiencing homelessness said that they were mandated to attend treatment, but that sober homes were their only option for housing. When evicted, they were left to the streets with no place to go and no resources to assist them. For residents, many were unaware of MASH or how to file a complaint, or they prioritized finding new housing while navigating street homelessness. In addition, the former residents complained about the range of down deposits in rent. Rent seemed to be an average of $600 to $800 per month with $500 deposits, which were often capped upon eviction, leaving many evicted residents with little to no money in their pockets. We've even heard of a rare home that is a MASH member charging up to $1,500 a month for added clinical services, but still without oversight. Another concern former residents brought to us is that most sober homes do not accept people on methadone or buprenorphine. For data listed by a popular outpatient treatment program, only 40% of the program's sober housing partners and only 35% of their MASH partners allow methadone. A fourth of their partners still do not even allow buprenorphine, also known as Suboxone. In 2017, 20% of all Minnesota treatment referrals involved opioid use disorder. Methadone and buprenorphine are the only approved treatments in the U.S. that are shown to reduce risk of fatal overdose. With not only the media reports of overdose deaths at sober homes, but from the stories we have heard from past residents and being in an overdose crisis, these numbers are incredibly concerning. Additionally, the rights of people on medications for opioid use disorder are protected by federal non-discrimination laws, including the Fair Housing Act. Residents said that they had to make a decision to either be forced off their medication or struggle to find openings at the few homes that accept them while balancing treatment and the legal systems. Our organization support Housing First policy. We do not want to lessen access to people who require sober housing, but expand it. Our organization is comprised of members in recovery, former sober housing residents, addiction counseling, and mental health interns. And based on our discussions, we urge the legislature to consider an opportunity to develop an approach to regulations that will protect and preserve the human rights of sober housing residents. We support this bill to study oversight of sober housing programs and believe it is needed to protect our most vulnerable populations of people with substance use disorders. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. O'Brien. Chris Edrington from MASH, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Chris Edrington. I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to comment today. This matter is of great concern to us. I'm the co-founder of NAR, the National Association of Recovery Residents, mentioned by Representative Edelson. I currently serve on its board. I'm also a member of the MASH board, the Minnesota Association of Sober Homes, or Sober Houses. I'm a founding member of both boards. And I operate St. Paul Sober Living, which is a sober living network of about 12 houses, about 105 beds in Minnesota mostly, and some in Colorado. And I've been doing that since 2001. Since its founding, NAR has similar relationships with the state affiliates. In other words, so MASH belongs to NAR as a state affiliate. There are 30 MASHs around the country in different acronyms associated with those states, many of which were formed in partnership with state legislatures and other addiction agencies on the state level. So for 10 years, we've been doing the work in the context of sober house oversight, both statewide and nationally. So I think that's one of the most important clear points to make today. NAR has developed the national best practices and standards for operating sober homes and other forms of recovery housing. So when somebody refers to a recovery residence, that's an umbrella term for lots of different types of sober houses. NAR has working relationships with the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the White House Office for National Drug Control Policy, National Council for Behavioral Health, the National Association of State and Alcohol and Drug Abuse Directors, and several other agencies and organizations. NAR is acknowledged by these and others as the national expert on recovery housing. Together with the National Council for Behavioral Health, NAR developed a policy guide for state legislatures and agencies, laying out the reasons for adopting that model titled Building Recovery, the State Policy Guide for Supporting Recovery Housing, which is this. And I've asked our administrator for MASH, Will, to email either a link or a document to anybody who wants it. So all you got to do is ask, and we'll send that to you. Together with the National Council for Behavioral Health, NAR developed a policy guide, which is the one I just remembered, and I think it's important, or the one I just mentioned, and I think it's important to understand that in the context of oversight of a sober living home and the day-to-day sort of milieu and the way that we operate that particular environment, when you hear about complaints and you hear about problems with sober houses, but you also understand the way that we do it and how important it is to keep people out of the house that are using, a lot of it starts to make sense. It can sound like it's on fire if you say that a whole bunch of people got kicked out when it was 10 below in January in Minnesota, but that's anecdotal and not necessarily relevant. Although there are people who do get evicted at inopportune times, I think if you understand the context with this and talk to people at MASH, you'll have a much more thorough understanding of it. So together with the National Council, oh, I'm sorry, I already read that part. Let's see. What Minnesota really needs to do is work with experts, NAR and MASH, to implement the oversight framework that's outlined in that guide. As to a state-funded study, we have a better idea. Pending federal legislation, the Excellence in Recovery Act, Representative David Trone of Maryland is behind that, will provide funding for a more comprehensive study than one proposed here. There's no reason for spending tax dollars to do something that is less thorough. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have and also put committee members in contact with the experts at NAR or MASH and for a more in-depth discussion of supporting world-class system of recovery housing in Minnesota. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Edrington. We have two questions from members. I hope you're going to be brief. This bill was heard in Behavioral Health Division extensively with lots of testimony and questions. So really, we should focus on the fiscal impact of the bill, which I believe the last fiscal note was $136,000. Representative Liebling.
All right. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. You answered part of my question right there, but the other part was, and I think this is a great idea, Representative Adelson. Thanks for bringing it. The question I have is, how are these services generally paid for? I heard Ms. O'Brien sort of implied that a lot of the time it's out of a person's pocket. Is there any state or federal money that flows to help people pay for these services?
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Liebling. There, it is all paid for by cash out of the person's pocket. It does not, insurance, there's no coverage for it currently. There are states, though, who have adopted policies that have then used state dollars to help fund some sober homes. So, you know, we really are trying to work with MASH in this process to really benefit everyone.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try to keep it brief. My question is for the bill author, Representative Edelson. Thank you for your work on this important topic. I had the opportunity a few weeks ago to visit and talk with a sober home in the district I represent and just hear their inspiring stories on their path to recovery. And they are currently not a member of the Minnesota Association of Sober Homes, which I know is explicitly included as a stakeholder in your bill. And so, Representative Edelson, my question is, will sober homes that are not members of MASH be included as stakeholders? And what advice would you give to me that I should communicate back to my constituents about how they can become involved in this process?
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Rasmussen, thank you for your question. I think absolutely they should be included in this. I think the importance here is we don't want to be the hard, handed government coming down on people. What we really want is consumer protections. Sober homes do great work, and we want both that are part of MASH and that are not part of MASH. To what Mr. Edrington said is we might be the national expert, but we don't have protections necessarily here. Really, this study is really working with everybody from people that are in MITNASH to NAR standards to looking at, Representative Albright brought up in the bill before, many people have co-occurring issues. It's not they're dealing with sobriety, but they're also dealing with a mental health struggle as well. And so really making sure that we're involving as many people so that we really continue to be the place people want to come for recovery.
Thank you, Representative Ellison. Representative Rasmussen?
Thank you, Representative Edelson. And the only thing I wanted to add is, it's my understanding, I could be corrected on here, that a number of sober homes essentially receive housing support through counties as part of the funding mechanism. And I know there are some issues with that I've heard from conversations with sober home residents and administrators. So I hope that that's a part of this conversation going forward as well.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question goes to Representative Edelson. But I note in the packet that there is an amendment offered by MASH, and I'm wondering if you would speak to that and whether or not that will be taken up at some point by you, or how would we wish to proceed with that amendment based upon your concerns for it.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Albright. So what is in the packet and what MASH had submitted was a delete all, and it was the Washington policy that they adopted. Now, we did look at that, and I truly don't believe that it's the best policy just to take what Washington did. We have numerous states throughout the nation that have adopted different policies. I think that the study of all the stakeholders coming together can look at what Washington has done, but they can look at what Connecticut has done. They can look at Illinois and see what works for our state and what works for people going through sobriety and people, the sober home. So that's what it's the delete all from the Washington policy. But I mean, it doesn't seem like at this point good policy to just adopt that without having all stakeholders involved.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would request if Mr. Edrington would speak to his delete all amendment.
Mr. Edrington.
I think actually John Curtis can speak to the amendment. He's on here and he wrote it. I didn't have.
Mr. Curtis.
Yes, the delete all, thank you, first, John Curtis. I'm the co-chair of MASH and one of the co-founders of MASH. The delete all amendment was taken in large part from the state of Washington, but it also used language from Colorado, some from Illinois. So, I mean, we kind of looked across the board at what other states were doing, and primarily partnering with the certification body in the state to, you know, provide a national registry and also require that all people being referred to sober houses be referred to places that are on the registry, which doesn't require that people are on the registry, but it does say that if you want referrals from treatment centers and providers in the state, then you have to be NAR certified and MASH certified and meet the criteria.
Thank you, Mr. Curtis. Sorry to cut you off, but we are at time. This amendment was not before the committee, but was discussed in behavioral health. So I'm going to renew my motion that this bill, House File 287, be laid over for possible inclusion in Human Services Finance Omnibus Bill. Thank you, Representative Edelson, for bringing the bill forward. Members, we're going to meet tomorrow and discuss homeless youth, and three bills are on the agenda. So with that, we are adjourned.